This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by the Sympathizer podcast from HBO. From executive producers Park Chan-wook and Robert Downey Jr., The Sympathizer is the new HBO original limited series based on the Pulitzer Prize-winning novel of the same name. On The Sympathizer podcast, join host Philip Nguyen in conversation with the cast, crew, and author Viet Thanh Nguyen as they discuss the making of this historic series. Stream new episodes of HBO's The Sympathizer, Sundays exclusively on Max, and listen to The Sympathizer podcast wherever you listen to podcasts.
Listener supported, WNYC Studios.
This is the New Yorker Radio Hour, a co-production of WNYC Studios and the New Yorker.
Welcome to the New Yorker Radio Hour. I'm David Remnick. Jack Antonoff is a very busy man. In the midst of the long pandemic, Antonoff co-wrote and co-produced not one, but two albums with Taylor Swift. And one of those, Folklore, won the Grammy for Album of the Year. Antonoff was also hard at work producing other albums for Lorde, Lana Del Rey, and Claro, all of which are out this year. And the producer also has a record of his own coming out. The album is called Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night, and it's his third with the band Bleachers. It's the kind of music you want from a Jersey guy. Music you can blast while driving fast down the turnpike, heavy on the horns, and the big emotions. Stop making this hurt. Say goodbye like you mean it. Stop trying on this hurt. Just say goodbye like you mean it. Say goodbye like you mean it. I spoke with Antonoff recently, and he was in his home studio with guitars and recording gear all over the place. And in the corner, the bust of a former president. Was that John Kennedy?
Yeah. My dad had this Kennedy bust in the house, and I.
So it's you in the Oval Office have that.
Yeah, it's a really good vibe.
Now, Jack, you have a new album. It's called "Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night." It makes me want to ask, how are your Saturday nights right now? How has the pandemic treated you and your work?
I've been okay. I wonder if you can relate as a writer, where it's like, I drift into spaces that were always alone spaces. And so a lot of my life in the pandemic was this knowledge of how intensely the world had changed, but my body was doing the same thing. You know, this room I'm in right now, I'm in, the door shuts and that's that. But the pandemic was like, look, I think it was a wonderful, it was devastating, but the one mega upside was it kind of hit the gas on this feeling that's been bubbling of the futures here, and we're all bored out of our minds. You know, everyone's got a personal assistant on their phone. I want a burger, it comes. Martin Scorsese makes movies for me on Netflix. You know, I sit home and it all gets pumped in. And all of a sudden, no matter where you sit, whoever you are on any spectrum of politics, class, religion, anything, you can't find a person who's like, my ideal Saturday night is to watch Netflix and order food, you know. So I think that's good, because I think that the whole, the future's here and we kind of want to walk into traffic, is, it's good to recognize.
Now, you tweeted that you felt very heavy about this album. What did you mean? Where's that weight coming from?
I spent so much time writing about grief and loss. My sister died when I was 18. It's a very singular experience. It's a tragic experience in my life. And it took me years to realize the space around it, which I think is an interesting trapdoor with trauma. I noticed it with friends, especially if you're young, or, you know, I was 18 as a formative time. It becomes the rug in which everything gets swept under. Everything is, well, your sister died, your sister died, your sister died, or this trauma, this tragedy. And I think this thing happens where you become like sort of a personal genius in one language of grief, but like an infant and everything else, all those years that my friends were examining themselves and their tendencies and their parents, I was just sort of like, anything dark with me is from this trauma. And that's not true. And that's actually a really dangerous place.
To be crude, you mean it was an excuse or a catch-all in some way?
It is. And it's this album got really heavy for me because for the first time, I knew I wasn't going to write another batch of songs about grief because it's something that lives you forever, but I felt like I'd explored it. So then I started exploring all these other things, and this is where, you know.
What did you feel you were exploring in this album?
All the things I missed because I kicked everything under the rug of grief.
And what are we including there?
I mean, not to be too broad, but why I'm this way, my tendencies, the systems in my family that don't work, the ones that do. I came to take the Saturday Night because what I started to realize is that there's an evil eye. It might be Jewish, it might be cultural, it might be my specific family. There's a darkness that hangs pretty intensely, and I want more out of my life, and I want to break into the next phase of my life, and that's weird. So I kept seeing this image of a doorway, and there's all this hope and joy on the other side, right? There's all this frustration and anxiety of, like, sometimes it's literal, like, you're holding this bag, and it's like, you can't take it all through. It doesn't work. I do not get through this door with all this shit. I know that. You know, I wrote songs called, like, How Dare You Want More.
Well, I was just going to ask you about this.
Very
tell me
pointed.
About that song.
That song came from letting go of some anger towards my parents, because I found some things out, and when I started to like really look at their relationship and our home life, and you know, nothing horrible, but just stuff in which I'm like, God, you put this crap on me, and I got to live with it. It's the reason why I have all this trouble. And you know, after some time, I started to say, no, these are human characters who want more. You know, and I'm not talking about money. I'm not talking about a bigger house, obviously. I'm talking about more. You know, more out of your life and the things you really desire. So much darkness wrapped up in that for people. There's no amount of sort of work success that ever makes one feel better about these, like, big rubs in their personal life. They're just separate. They're just separate.
You worked with Bruce Springsteen on one of these songs, and he has talked about, I mean, late in his career, he's talked about battling with depression for year after year and comes and goes, but he didn't really confront it until middle age. Is that useful to you, to talk to other musicians who are older than you, not just about the music, but about the experience of this seeming ideal creative life, successful creative life, and the realities of when you come home from the performance?
Remarkably important to me. I would call it like soul saving. Bruce and Patty are incredibly, I've touched on a little bit here and there, but incredibly important figures in my life because, you know, there's a lot of people who have great careers and there's a lot of people who have really, you know, kind of like great, robustly vulnerable personal lives. There are very few people who can hold both. And if you're out there trying to have both, which I am, which, you know, there's a certain shame that even comes in saying that. How dare you want more? Man, you better find some people to believe in.
I'm talking with Jack Antonoff, and his new record is called Take the Sadness Out of Saturday Night. More in a moment.
Hi, I'm Roz Chast from The New Yorker. The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported by NetSuite. Okay, quick math. The less your business spends on operations, on delivering your product or service, the more money you keep. Obvious. But with higher expenses on materials, employees, distribution, and borrowing, everything costs more. So to reduce costs and headaches, smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required. You cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified platform. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/New Yorker. netsuite.com/New Yorker.
WNYC Studios is supported by Rocket Money. Did you know nearly 75% of people have subscriptions they've forgotten about? Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills so that you can grow your savings. Rocket Money will even try to negotiate your bills for you by up to 20%. All you have to do is submit a picture of your bill, and Rocket Money takes care of the rest. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has saved a total of $500 million in canceled subscriptions, saving members up to $740 a year when using all of the app's features. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/WNYC. That's rocketmoney.com/WNYC.
Yeah, we both have to fess up. We grew up in neighboring towns. You a little bit after me, of course, you in Wycliffe Lake and me in a town nearby called Hillsdale. And what that turf, which I was, when I was growing up there, which I thought of as terribly boring, couldn't wait to leave, you know, get me to New York as soon as possible. What did that turf give you in your creative life?
Well, I felt the same way. It gave me boredom, which gave me dreams. You know, I always, you know, we're obviously diving deep into a lot of like Springsteen culture, but one of the reasons why his work means so much to me is there's a fine line between loving music and hearing yourself and your experience. I mean, when I heard it started with him, he's the architect of it, then it was this local scene and all of the other great music from the shore that I started to discover. You know, first of all, it's the literal landscape. You're hearing streets and places you know, but it's this feeling that there isn't really a word for it. You could say outside the window of the party, you could say younger brother, you could make the medieval comparison calling the Hudson River a moat. But it's deeper. It's our culture. It's we are not there, but we are right there, which is, it's not small town thinking. It's a whole, I mean, let's look at it scientifically. How much energy is coming off of New York City and then dying as it hits New Jersey? I think we grew up in the sort of like metaphorical ash of energy.
All of New Jersey would be thrilled to hear it.
Yeah, but here's the thing, you know, how much beauty does that create? I mean, let's look at New York music, right? Velvet Underground, Strokes, right? Reporting from the center of the world. It's all been there, done that. The first Stroke record when I was younger came out was called Is This It? ? Mm-hmm. You know, let's compare and contrast Is This It with Born to Run. You know, like, I mean, and it's true in my life. The kids I met, I just wanted to be in the city. I wanted to be a New York City band. I wanted to be around it. I fucking grew up knowing every band that was playing in the city that night and not being able
to go. Yeah.
But it creates darkness and it creates a lot of hope. It creates dreams. There's somewhere to go. It's almost like people who have a very successful father seem to have a tough time. And I feel like growing up in New Jersey, I had nowhere to, and I was lucky. You know, we never worried about food on the table. You could look it up. It's a nice town. We had a nice house. I played t-ball. I went to Jewish school. Like, you know, our worries were not deep. But I never thought that I couldn't outdo my upbringing.
Now, what has stunned me musically about you over time, and is how much music and musical styles you've incorporated into your work as a musician, as a producer. How does that happen? Did you grow up liking music, country music, for example?
Well, yes and no, because I look back. Well, my dad, interesting story about my dad, is there's a ragtime musician named Reverend Gary Davis.
Guitar player,
brilliant.
And everybody loved getting lessons from him, all kinds of people.
My dad was one of them.
Yeah.
So I think it was Bergenfield, New Jersey. I think at the time, you could go get a lesson from Reverend Gary Davis, which is crazy.
Unbelievable.
And amazing. So my dad learned in that style, and the style is very specific. It's this sort of fast back and forth picking.
It's really hard.
One sec.
Sure.
Sorry, I'm just grabbing this off the wall.
If you can do this, I'm always impressed with you, but if you can do this, you're my hero.
It's really hard, but this is like, so I'm going to play something really poorly that my dad plays great. It's like this kind of style. Fuck, it's like, oh, okay. So it's that kind of, and that's a...
See, if I could do that, I would die happy. Immediately.
But then, yeah, so the level, if you see my dad do it, it's a language, this kind of playing. And it flows through you where your thumb is moving back and forth seamlessly and you're picking in between. It's got all these blues undertones and just southern undertones, and there's even like this jazz to it. Long story short, I think it opened this idea of me of just like, oh, like there's different kinds of music, because it wasn't just popular music flowing through the house.
You're known not only as a musician and as a writer, but also as an extremely successful and varied producer working with other people. You've done albums with Lana Del Rey, with Lorde. You've done a lot of this since your last album with Bleachers. At what point did producing other artists really take hold for you?
Well, the funny thing about being a producer, and I've only sort of, I realized this when I was getting into it, like, if you're a songwriter, you can write songs. If you're a performer, you could probably find an open mic night and you might get booed off the stage, but you're a performer. You can't really be a producer unless someone admits that you're a producer. And so I always produced my own records and loved it. But if you do it for yourself, it's a little bit more like, oh, you just kind of make your own records. It's really that lens that someone else sees you through, where they're like, oh, this person can be my producer. And Taylor Swift was the first person who said, we made a song together and I made it sound like everything I wanted it to sound like. And she said, cool, that's that. And that kicked the door wide open.
Jack, one of the collaborations that is really knocked me flat, and it also surprised me when I first heard about it, is you've got a song on the album called 91.
Yeah.
And your collaborator is one Zadie Smith. Tell me
about
that.
That's your world.
So tell me how it came about.
I know Zadie a little bit, and I ran into her near Electric Lady, which is in the West Village. And I'm sure you know Zadie. You know, she's not someone that's like high and by it, sort of like high, and then 5 minutes later, it's like, and that's why this crushing weight is in tow wherever I go. And what do you think of matcha? You know, it's a sort of, she's a heavy character.
And she can sing, by the way.
She can really sing, and she loves music. So I thought, huh, you know, I work with people who are in music. Zadie's a brilliant writer. I have this song, which I'm having a very, very hard time with. What if Zadie helped me frame it? You just sort of give this unknowing permission where you make space for someone to be like, you know what you could do there? And that was the story with Zadie, and she helped me put it together. She actually sings on a little bit. And the interesting thing about 91 is then I had this mountain with the production. I just could not get that song right. And it ended up being Zadie helping me with the lyrics, St. Vincent coming up with the idea of the strings, and then Warren Ellis, who plays in the Dirty Three and the Bad Seeds, one of my favorite musicians in the world, playing those parts. And it made me feel like this sort of cast of heroes of mine kind of pushing me into the album.
It's 91, no horizon, I'm watching black, white, and green. My mother dances around like there ain't no rip in the scene. While she waltzes with ghosts, I can feel what went wrong. Yeah, she's here, but she's not. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Just like her, I'm not home. Yeah, I'm here, but I'm not.
Now, you haven't played in front of a live audience, I assume, in quite a while, right?
Once. I played, when we played How Dare You Want More on Fallon, there was 100 people there. And that was my first audience in, you know, I guess 2 years.
How'd that feel?
Felt amazing. It wasn't my audience. I mean, there were a couple people, but, you know, there was also some people who, I guess, were probably at the gift shop of 30 Rock and got handed tickets. So, so those things are always a funny audience. But look, I think it's that cliche, you know, the car hits empty and there's that secret 20 miles. My grandfather, who is a rabbi, used to talk about this all the time, about human reserve. And I think it's a metaphor that comes to mind about live music. There's no part of me that ever thought it could be more special, more important, that we could go harder. And here we are. My first show is actually on September 11th. And I know it will be more. I don't know if I will be weeping. I don't know if the crowd will be weeping. I don't know if we'll disassociate. I don't know what the hell's going to happen, but it's going to be big.
I will be there. I will make it a point. Jack, thanks so much. It's really great talking to you.
Great to see you, David.
That's Jack Antonoff. Take the sadness out of Saturday Night is his third album with Bleachers, and it's out now. And that's the New Yorker Radio Hour for today. See you next time.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is a co-production of WNYC Studios and The New Yorker. Our theme music was composed and performed by Merrill Garbus of Tune Yards, with additional music by Alexis Quadrado. This episode was produced by Alex Barron, Emily Botin, Ave Carrillo, Rhiannon Corby, Kalalia, David Krasnow, Gofen and Putubwele, Louis Mitchell, Michelle Moses, Annabelle Bacon, and Stephen Valentino.
And we had additional help from Harrison Keithline.
The New Yorker Radio Hour is supported in part by the Chirina Endowment Fund.
At Radiolab, we love nothing more than nerding out about science, neuroscience, chemistry.
But we do also like to get into other kinds of stories. Stories about policing. Or
politics.
Country music.
Hockey.
Sex. Of bugs.
Regardless of whether we're looking at science or not science, we bring a rigorous curiosity to get you the answers.
And hopefully make you see the world anew.
Radiolab, adventures on the edge of what we think we know.
Wherever you get your podcasts.